Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is August 27, 1979, and this is my audio letter number 49. As I say these words, the slow, lazy days of summer 1979 are drawing to a close. Most of us are sorry to see them go. For many people, summer is a time to ignore the outside world as much as possible. It's time to relax, to bask in the sun, to pretend that today will blend into tomorrow without change or trouble. Television news programs in these later days of August have been filled with items that reinforce this mood. Even the alleged president has seemingly found time to lay aside the tedium of doing his job. And for a week or more, we were assured by television reports that the Carter-Robotoid family were enjoying a tranquil steamboat ride down the Mississippi River. To all appearances, this Robotoid president has had nothing to do except jog around the boat deck, shake hands with well-wishers, and give the same energy speech over and over. If he can take life that easy, we think, why shouldn't we relax too? But, my friends, at this very moment, the world is in ferment as never before. If you depend on television news and newspaper headlines, as most people do, the world may seem to be just rolling along just like Old Man River. But if you want to have some hint of what is really taking place today, you should listen to the shortwave radio. Get into the habit of listening to the BBC World Service, to Radio Moscow World Service, to Radio Australia, to Radio South Africa, even Radio Canada right next door to us. It often contains important reports which you will never hear through our domestic major media. You might even tune in the Voice of America once in a while. There, too, you may hear things you will never hear in our domestic news media and without commercials. But, my friends, you should listen to these with a certain amount of charity, for they all have their own biases. There's not enough time in this entire tape even to list all the important areas of ferment in our world. But for a moment, let me just skim the surface for you. Then ask yourself whether the slick, major media image of our country and the world is real or artificial. Not long ago, the boat people from Vietnam were filling our headlines. Vietnam was expelling large numbers of its people. Most all of them were Chinese, not Vietnamese. Vietnam has become a client state of Russia and is preparing for possible all-out war with China. Of all countries, Vietnam knows the dangers of internal strife at this time, and so all those who refuse to cooperate with the present regime are being rounded up and expelled in one way or another. Vietnam is in a hurry, because already tensions are building again along the border with China. The boat people now constitute a refugee problem of staggering proportions. Hundreds of thousands of people are crammed into refugee camps. Even so, the recent actions of Vietnam should be placed in proper perspective. In 35 years of continuous war in Indochina, the mass expulsion of political undesirables is a new phenomenon. In the past, the actions of the former Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, now known as Kampuchea, would have been more typical. When the Chinese-backed Pol Pot regime took control of Cambodia several years ago, a reign of terror began. It was alleged that more than 1 million Cambodians were murdered by their own government. Most of them were members of the middle class, regardless of their ethnic background. In that way, the Pol Pot regime broke the back of any possible resistance. If the present regime in Vietnam were carrying on according to these traditional methods, there would be no boat people. Instead, there would be only mass graves throughout Vietnam. There would be no television pictures of pathetic refugees crammed into boats, and there would be no controversy over Vietnam's actions, because at most all we would hear would be a few passing rumors. Then, all would be quiet again. The shift in Vietnam's behavior, my friends, is the result of Russian pressure. Since the end of the Vietnam War, all remaining Chinese influence in Vietnam has been rooted out. Vietnam is now purely a Russian client state, And like Russia herself, Vietnam is getting rid of internal enemies by expelling them. As for the bloody Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, that was recently overthrown by the Vietnamese invasion. The ferment in Indochina is visible elsewhere too. Recently, the United States has started speeding up arms shipments to Thailand, but the United States government is now coming under Russia's control, so for all intents and purposes, Thailand's fate is already sealed. Soon it too will enter the Russian orbit. Russia's continuing encirclement of China is moving right along. Early in 1978, my friends, I alerted you to watch for America's doors to start opening wide to Red China. Within a few months, the news was filled with comments that we had decided to play the so-called China card. It was all a panicky attempt by America's real rulers to buy time against Russia. During the final months of 1977, Russia had wrestled the military control of space away from the United States. This had altered completely the East-West balance of power. But due to the death of the real Leonid Brezhnev on January 7, 1978, our rulers thought they had a chance. They expected the Kremlin to be divided by infighting to decide Brezhnev's successor. They thought they could keep the Kremlin off balance for 2 to 3 years. Using that time, they would rush ahead with secret weapons programs on a crash basis. And so America tried to play the China card. Before the year of 1978 was out, the Carter administration announced that the United States was establishing diplomatic relations with China, but it was an act of pure desperation. The late four Rockefeller brothers had badly underestimated the tightly knit band of Christians who now rule Russia. Since March 1978, Marshal Dmitry Ustinov has been the top man in the Kremlin. At the proper time, he will step down in favor of a younger man, but for now, the Kremlin power structure is stable and effective. Current events in Asia demonstrate an important fact. America's attempt to play the so-called China card was a failure. It's no longer fashionable even to speak in those terms. China's invasion of Vietnam early this year of 1979 showed up the United States as a paper tiger in Asia. By contrast, Russia's profile there is becoming taller and taller. As I revealed long ago, China was actually playing the America card to get the best deal possible with Russia. Next month, formal talks will begin in Moscow between China and Russia toward improving relations between the two. 6 years ago in my book, I warned about the forces leading to a vast new Asian axis. Today, this axis built around Russia, China, and Japan is coming together, but Russia is making sure there's no doubt in anyone's mind about who will be its leader. Even on the eve of major talks between Russia and China, Russia does not hesitate to point fingers at China. For example, look at Afghanistan on Russia's southern border, which is now a Russian client state. Civil war has been underway there for 9 months. Early this month, a 4-hour pitched battle took place right in the capital city of Kabul. Afghan radio has charged that trained guerrillas, anti-revolutionaries, have entered Afghanistan from neighboring Iran and Pakistan, and Russia charges that some of these intruders were trained in China. In ways like this, my friends, Russia is putting pressure not only on China, but also on Pakistan and Iran. This is part of Russia's preoccupation with bordering states, which I have explained in the past. Afghanistan and Iran both border on Russia, and Russia wants secure borders. Pakistan is a land bridge from Afghanistan to the Arabian Sea. Russia has historically wanted a land corridor in this area for access to the Indian Ocean. In other ways, too, Pakistan is being given good reason to think over her attitude toward Russia. Lately, Pakistan's relations with the United States have taken a turn for the worse. Earlier this month, on August 11th, the New York Times made public some stunning policy planning within the State Department. Pakistan is very close to creating its own atomic bomb, but the Times revealed that the United States intends to stop Pakistan one way or another. One of the options under specific consideration has brought a stinging protest by Pakistan, and no wonder. That option is covert operations. That, my friends, is exactly the option used by the United States in Guyana last November. In the case of Pakistan, those operations would involve sabotage of her atomic installations. Here at home, of course, sabotage is supposed to be inconceivable. All across the world, the ferment increasingly has the flavor of dramatic change. For example, less than a decade ago, the United States supported Pakistan in the war with India, and for 5 years now, India has had the atomic bomb. But now, the United States reportedly wants to stop Pakistan from getting it. But things have changed, my friends. The Rockefellers a decade ago were at the peak of their power. India was slated for conquest in a plan which later ousted Indira Gandhi from power. But as I have revealed in recent tapes, the four Rockefeller brothers are no more. Their old allies who overthrew them, the atheistic Bolsheviks, have also been stopped in their tracks. It is now Russia who controls most all the top echelons of the United States government. And as Pakistan ponders a changed America, Indira Gandhi is staging a comeback in India. In the past year, the biggest change of all has gone unannounced in our daily news. The end of a dynasty has taken place, the Rockefeller dynasty. It began a year ago last month with the eldest of the four brothers, John D. III. In AUDIO LETTER 36, I revealed how his death would cause Rockefeller efforts in Africa and Asia to start unraveling. And today, the headless Rockefeller cartel is losing fast in southern Africa. The initiative is shifting back to Britain, which has established a special secret relationship with Russia. As for Asia, I have already pointed out the collapse of America's so-called China card strategy, notwithstanding the present visit to China of the robotoid Mondale. Turning to the Persian Gulf, we keep hearing about United States plans for a large contingency force. This force, known as the Quick Reaction Corps, would rush to the Gulf to protect our oil lifeline in time of crisis. But throughout the Gulf region itself, this plan has raised cries of protest. It's an offshoot of the plan I made public a year ago to set up an American first strike against Russia. But even without knowing that, it's obvious to everyone that the force would mean trouble. Kuwait has already served notice in public that the United States must not deploy these forces in the Gulf. If we do, Kuwait will destroy her own oil wells. At this time last year, the Shah of Iran was still in power, but the upheaval in Iran, which was tied to the secret American war plan, ended his rule earlier this year. The revolution in Iran was also designed to break the access by British Petroleum to Iranian oil. That has left practically the whole pie to the Rockefeller Big Oil cartel. But increasingly, the Khomeini regime has turned out to be an awkward puppet for Big Oil. Now Iran is becoming destabilized by internal strife among Kurds, Arabs, and leftist Iranians. And lately, there have been huge demonstrations in Iran favoring the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Iranian demonstrations have also been against Israel and the United States, as if the two were one. Meanwhile, Israeli artillery continues to pound southern Lebanon almost daily, and yet there has been an obvious shift in America's Middle East policy. Several weeks ago, Israeli Foreign Minister Dayan said publicly that a shift had taken place recently. There were official denials, but now the Andrew Young affair has created a bombshell for United States policy in the Middle East. And here at home, smoldering tensions between blacks and Jews have been fanned into open flames. And so it goes, my friends. Wherever you look, you will see the ferment of change. One way to look at this is to tell yourself that all these things are unrelated, just as they are presented in the news. Viewed in that way, world events are impossible to understand or even remember. That's the attitude that says there's no cause for human events. They just happen. But, my friends, there is a cause for everything we see. The sun does not rise every day by accident. There's a reason for it. And the world is not stirring with the winds of change by accident. There's a reason for it. This month, as always, I want to focus your attention on the reasons behind current events. Knowing these, you can better understand the individual events and the news for yourself. Maybe you can't always affect these events directly, but it's always better to be aware than to be taken by surprise. And for those who are not aware, there will be many surprises in these days of radical changes. My three special topics this month are Topic number 1, Russia's Transformation of America's Middle East Policy. Topic number 2, The Domestic Fallout of the Andrew Young Affair. And Topic number 3, Russia's Two-Front War Against Rothschild World Power. Topic number 1. One summer night 1974, I was in the studios of a New York City radio station. The station was WMCA. The program was the famous Long John Neville Show. For quite some time, the late Long John Neville had been having me on his program as a guest once a month for about 6 hours. But that night, I was asked a question about the Middle East. In my answer, I said, among other things, that the troubles there began with the Palestinians and the Israelis, and they will end with the Palestinians and Israelis. Now, many Zionist listeners were shocked to hear these words. For them, the Palestinians did not exist. And since that night, I have never again been allowed to appear on WMCA or any other New York radio station. The then owner of WMCA is now the head of the Voice of America. Can you imagine? It has now been 5 years since I said those forbidden words about the Palestinians. Today as then, the Zionists here and in Israel bristle with hostility at the very word Palestinian. And for most of those 5 years, American policy toward the Palestinians has echoed that of Zionists and of Israel. 4 years ago in 1975, Israel was secretly guaranteed that this policy would continue by the late Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. This policy was never passed on by Congress. As recently as last March 26, 1979, American policy was still to exclude the Palestinians. On that day, the so-called Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty was signed in Washington. It did not amend this 1975 policy in any way, and so it continued to lock out the Palestinians. In AUDIO LETTER 44, I explained how this secret policy was intended to lead very quickly not to peace, but the war in the Middle East. That in turn was to lead to an American nuclear first strike against Russia. The secret American plan, which I made public 1 year ago this month in AUDIO LETTER 37, was moving fast. But since that time, dramatic changes have been taking place in America's foreign policy. This includes our foreign policy in general and our Middle East policy in particular. The changes began last April 1979 behind the scenes. At that time, the changes were not yet visible to the public. But that month, I reported to my listeners that a secret war of doubles had broken out in Washington. The intelligence agencies of Russia, Britain, and Israel were struggling for control of the United States government. Our own CIA was in disarray. The CIA had always been David Rockefeller's private detective agency, but by then David Rockefeller was dead, replaced by a double. Rockefeller power in America had been shattered. In AUDIO LETTER 45, I reported that Russia was gaining the upper hand in the war of doubles. The following month, I was able to reveal why they were winning. I also reported that two super-secret diplomatic shuttles to the Middle East had taken place. The shuttles involved what appeared to be top American officials, but it was actually a Russian operation to stop the Middle East war plan. And that was only the first step in Russia's plan to revolutionize United States policy in the Middle East. Many of my listeners seem to have ignored the detailed report I gave on these shuttles in AUDIO LETTER No. 46. For one thing, there was no hint about these developments in the major media news at that time. And if anything, the Middle East appeared to be on the back burner. But I think the significance of the shuttles may have been overlooked by many people for another reason. AUDIO LETTER No. 46 was the tape in which I first revealed Russia's secret weapon, that is, organic robotoids. These artificial, living, robot-like creatures are shocking and mind-boggling. Their mere existence is a hard fact to absorb. So when I describe their use in the shuttles later in the tape, it may have sounded minor by comparison. My friends, the events of recent days regarding the Middle East are the direct result of those shuttles. They initiated a radical shift in America's Middle East policy, because that policy is now being established by the Kremlin. I would urge you to go back and listen again to what you heard in AUDIO LETTER No. 46, especially regarding the Middle East shuttles. Then the events of recent days should be much easier for you to understand. On June 18, 1979, the SALT II signing took place in Vienna, Austria. America's turnabout in favor of SALT II is another aspect of Russia's takeover here. I've discussed that in recent tapes. But on the same day as the SALT II signing, another important meeting took place in Vienna. The robotoid replacement for Secretary of State Cyrus Vance met with Austria's Chancellor Bruno Kreisky. Kreisky is a Jew, but like many Jews, he has no sympathy with a political force known as Zionism. In the recent past, he has made scolding attacks on the ruling circles in Israel. In public statements about this, Kreisky has used words such as paranoid, a police state, to describe the Israeli government. The tough band of Christians who now rule Russia agree completely. Like Kreisky, the Russians have often made public statements blasting Zionism. In topic number 3, I'll say more about the controversy over Zionism, because this controversy is now moving onto center stage in a struggle over the future of all mankind. In the Kreisky meeting with the Vance robotoid, the diplomatic status of the Palestinians was discussed. 10 days earlier, United States Ambassador to Austria, Milton Wolf, had already had a meeting with a representative of the PLO. Kreisky said he intended to invite Arafat, the PLO leader, for a formal visit to Vienna. In that way, Kreisky would be initiating a quasi-official recognition of the PLO as a political force. On July 8, Arafat arrived in Vienna, creating headlines in Europe. Meanwhile, there had already been 3 meetings in Austria between United States Ambassador Wolf and a PLO representative. On July 31, a Jimmy Carter robotoid began setting the stage for the Andrew Young affair. In an interview, robotoid Carter compared the Palestinian problem to the civil rights movement in the United States. For days, Israeli leaders were boiling, and their sympathizers in this country denounced the Carter remarks. On August 5, Israeli Foreign Minister Dayan complained publicly that in the past 2 months or so, quote, "there has been a shift in United States policy," unquote. That shift, my friends, began with the secret robotoid shuttles, which I revealed 3 months ago. On August 13, Special Middle East Envoy Robert Strauss, or rather a Strauss robotoid, spoke before the American Bar Association in Dallas. He said the United States is committed to the security of Israel, but also, quote, "the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people," unquote. The same day, the Andrew Young affair began. Newsweek magazine broke the story that Young, as ambassador to the United Nations, had met with the UN observer of the PLO, Zehdi Terazi. The next day, the Israeli government loudly protested Young's action. The day after that, August 15, he resigned. Last month, I alerted you to watch for more changing faces and positions of power here in the United States. The departure of Andrew Young is part of this changing of the guard, but it's also much more. For one thing, the Young affair has highlighted the fact that America's Middle East policy is changing, and it did so in a way that cast the Palestinians in a far more favorable light than in the past. Equally important to Russia, Israel has been lured into giving itself a black eye. In the past, Israel could always claim that the PLO was making peace impossible, but now the PLO is concentrating on the diplomatic drive for a peaceful accommodation with Israel. Israel's response has been to try to sabotage this process. Worldwide, the reaction has been to start questioning whether Israel really wants peace. For example, on August 17, the BBC carried an interview with Anthony McDermott of the Financial Times of London. He was asked his opinion of the Israeli objective in bringing about the Young resignation. He replied in part, quote, "I would speculate that if the PLO were, through some miracle, to come out and say, 'We accept the existence of Israel,' it would be extremely embarrassing to Mr. Begin, because he's constantly comparing them to the Nazis." Unquote. Russia had foreseen that Israel would try to stop the United States policy shift. The Andrew Young affair has caused Israel to injure herself by these efforts. World opinion toward Israel is changing, but for Israel, the worst setback of all may be right here in the United States, because the domestic fallout, my friends, of the Andrew Young affair is not at all what Israel had in mind.